Alongside the breathless coverage of Democratic Party wins in Virginia and New Jersey this week, the media, who just cannot resist an anniversary, are reliving the first week of November 2016.
Well, it's been 1 year to the day since Donald Trump won the presidential election in the biggest upset in decades.
It's been 1 year since the Trump shock. Is the world still in a state of shock?
Well, it's time to wake up now, I think.
It's been 1 year since President Trump's historic victory, which shocked many. And 1 year later, our panel is here to examine the Trump administration.
I just caught this tweet from the president's account. It has to do on Twitter with winning. Congratulations to all of the deplorables and the millions of people who gave us a massive 304 to 227 electoral college landslide victory. You're not going to cry again, are you, Michael?
Anniversary pieces help us compare how we feel now to how we felt then. And this year in particular, it seems important to remind ourselves that the new normal started on November 7th, 2016. In July of this year, 8 months into the Donald Trump presidency, I walked into the OTM offices having had an epiphany of sorts. Executive producer Kat Rogers and Brooke insisted that we go into the studio to talk it through, and we will now flash back. But before that, let's flash back to our original post-election encounter session, which we first aired on November 9th, 2016.
Hi, everyone. This is Katia, executive producer of OTM. So as you can imagine, lots of feelings being felt here in the office Wednesday morning, feelings we didn't quite know what to do with. I thought, if I were an OTM listener, what would I want to hear? I would want to hear Bob and Brooke talking through how they are feeling today and how they envisioned the direction of the show during the Trump presidency. So we went into the studio to hash that out, and here it is.
So anyway, what happened last night made me think about what we've been doing the last couple of years, especially the last year, and what we ought to consider doing in the future. I don't think our role is to be Cassandra-in-chief or even consoler-in-chief. I think that our main role is to make what seems to have been invisible to us and everyone we know visible. We have to do an even better job of reporting and pull back, not entirely, of course, but to some degree from commentary. I'm not saying we extirpate it. It's part of our brand. We've always been transparent, and I want to continue that. I think we need to be more fair. And that means we have to talk to people that we have discounted.
Do you think that we were unfair?
With regard to the election, I think that we fell into the trap of everyone else. The focus was never on his supporters until the very end.
It's clear to me that while we imagined ourselves speaking truth to power, and I suppose we did, we were also very much stuck within the echo chamber. And to the extent that our message was getting out beyond the non-Trump supporting community, it was probably dismissed as simply liberal boilerplate. I don't necessarily regret doing that because I think we repeatedly had to make a judgment whether the historic threat to our democracy and to our values was reason enough to veer away from kind of in-depth reporting on what made the electorate what it is. And that may be true. But actually, I think the bigger story that the press missed overall has been the quintessential slow-boiling frog situation. And that is that there's been a 30-some year campaign of big lies, of demagogues in politics and in conservative media telling this ever-growing, more frustrated, more marginalized audience a number of things that are, you know, objectively untrue. I think that happened and kind of softened the target for an opportunist demagogue like Donald Trump. 50% of the electorate believes that we are under siege from all sides and our economy and our society is being destroyed, when objectively speaking, none of that's true. But it doesn't matter because the people who voted for Trump believe the collapse was underway. So I think that where the media failed was by letting the frog boil slowly to the point that the public, in a gigantic way, was misinformed. So what does that tell us about how to approach fairness? Are you being fair or unfair to your audience by reflexively throwing bones at ideas that you don't think have merit?
What you describe is in no way how I describe fairness. The way that I intend it is simply to put more voices on the air, not to give them a free ride, not to shy away from disputing every assertion they might make that the facts disagree with, simply to make them present.
And make us better informed.
About who they are.
Yeah.
But I don't think these explanations are mutually exclusive.
Well, I do, because if we focus on the 30-year lie, we're having an argument about stuff that happened during the Nixon administrations and not stuff that we've ignored. You've brought it up a lot this year. It has undergirded many of our discussions. But I think that it will drag us into a very established narrative when we really have to find out what's going on now.
Can we go mega transparent, Brooke?
Yeah.
Let's go mega transparent.
Sure, go ahead.
For the 16-year history of this show, we have had conversations in our editorial meetings that the audience is not privy to about stories in which we're fighting for truth, justice in the American way, and we're trying to decide how to report them or whether to report them. And there is a term of art.
And we haven't used it in years.
Yeah. The term is it too Democracy Now? Democracy Now! Is a longstanding radio show that its history is in public radio, not NPR, but public radio, and it is now broadcast on TV. It is a explicitly liberal, progressive bastion. And the question that I think that we face is, do we continue to go more in the direction that it takes, amp up the skepticism and outrage, or pull back and be, say, more dispassionate observers of the media scene and the political scene? I'm not sure if we can do both of those things.
So this is where you feel we have gone during the Trump campaign. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and thanks in large part to, you know, my insistence that we cover Trump not as a politician, but as a historic threat, a potential menace to democracy. So, yeah, I mean, I've been pounding that message as often as I can, and that crosses the line between journalism that we expect into a kind of activism. I don't think I ever mentioned Hillary Clinton's name during the whole course of the campaign, but I, and by extension the show, became an activist player in anti-Trumpism. So now what do we do? Now what do we do?
Remember during the Bush administration, we had to find a framing device. We were unnerved. We didn't know what was going to happen, but that was politics. We're like, well, that's not our beat. And so then we came up with enabling condition, which
was— Enabling condition, free speech and privacy, all those things that enable the freedom of information and that enable journalism that were not, strictly speaking, media.
Yeah, so we came up with the media frame. And then when Obama won in 08, we were like, what's our new frame? What's our discussion? What's it going to be? Really quickly turned to transparency, surveillance. What is our frame? What's it going to be? I feel like we don't know.
Well, I suspect that our media role, our function, will have to do with narratives and framing, constantly identifying and anatomizing those narratives of our colleagues in the mainstream media and also those outside of it.
One thing I think is going to be interesting is that we rely on historical context, right, to diffuse panic. Where's our historical precedent that makes us feel better?
Well,
I don't know. I don't know.
Don't complain to me about Godwin's law anymore.
Why?
No, that's
we
not.
Don't have Hitler.
But what happens if President Donald Trump does half the things he's promised to do?
If you're going to bring out the, you know, the rhetorical heavy artillery, you do it in response to actual real things, not to his own rhetorical flourishes. We don't hate Hitler because he made ugly speeches.
the political process is looking exactly like Weimar Germany, which was a nation that made a historically bad decision, catastrophic decision, based on exactly the same kind of fears and hatreds that have propelled Donald Trump into office. Now, whether that demagoguery turns into something deeply dark, I don't know. But, you know, I refuse to be put off the idea that the political forces aren't a direct parallel to what got Hitler elected before he did a single ugly act.
And you have made that observation, I think, probably half a dozen times on the show, but we are past the phase of the election.
I think that people will be listening to this discussion, our listeners, and they'll say, Bob and Brooke, tell me how to feel. What should I do today?
Well, speaking personally, I'm afraid and I'm ashamed and I'm angry. And as to what to do next, I don't know. But, I think Brooke and I, even though we've had this marriage encounter session, we fundamentally agree that On the Media's role is to keep our finger on the pulse of the nation and the media's coverage of the events as dispassionately as we can without surrendering our commitment to truth and sanity and the Constitution and all that goes with it. And, you know, the question is, do we try to approach our jobs as leaders of a movement for truth and justice, or do we just try to do our jobs as journalists covering journalism and let the rest sort itself out? I'm not sure we can do exactly both at the same time.
I guess I would say I think we can do exactly both at the same time. Just shining a light gives people the information to pursue their goals. And I guess if I were talking to the listener's cat, what I would say is simply, you know, you have a couple of choices. You can sit back and give way to panic and embrace all the terrible analogies, or we can simply keep our eyes open day by day and stay engaged. I mean, if you hate the outcome of this election, there is another one in 2 years that could change the Congress. This is about the American experiment and whether it fails. I mean, Krugman called America a failed state. That doesn't have to be. That doesn't have to be. The country is evenly divided. That means half of the nation agrees with you. So get everybody off their asses.
I hope that it's some sort of clarion call. But, what I most hope is that we are not all passengers on the ship of fools.
What the
I don't know
does
what that
mean
either.
What does it mean?
Why would you want to end on the line of we're all going to hell?
Perhaps I misunderstood, but if you wanted to know what I'm thinking and feeling and what we should do, I have just told you.
All right.
Now, you can think it's ridiculous and hyperbolic, but you thought my warnings about Trump were ridiculous and hyperbolic.
I did not.
Yeah, we didn't.
At some point, we have to reckon with what just happened last night.
Well, don't mischaracterize me and what was in my mind. If I had felt that way, they wouldn't have been on the program.
Well, I rest my case at Ship of Fools.
Okay.
And that wraps up the morning after.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, so that was recorded in November 2016. This summer, Kat made us listen to that again, and then once again turned on the mics to peek not just behind the curtain, but into our very alleged souls.
Okay, so that was a little more than 8 months ago. We were roiling in doubt. This show is devoted to doubt, the value of doubt. And we decided to listen to this again, Bob, because you'd had an epiphany this week. You found yourself in doubt.
Yeah, well, not quite an epiphany, because I think epiphanies are sudden. And this has been a gradual realization based on, of all things, my own media behavior, my own media diet. And if you'll permit me to try to distill our two positions that we just listened to, yours was to take the long view, not to be hysterical, not to be excessively self-righteous, and to provide our audience as much news, reporting, and context as we can. And I had a slightly different view. My view was, oh my God, we're doomed. We have to tell them how we're doomed. You know, something along those lines. And why? Because, as I said, I was angry, frightened, and ashamed. I thought and still do think that we are in a catastrophic historical political moment. And my impulse was not just to identify the problem, but to somehow be part of the solution, right? So that was where I was coming from that day.
And then you were about to tell us about your media consumption?
Yeah. So here's what happened. Let me tell you how my media diet works. I get up in the morning and I read the New York Times, but I also look at Google News, which feeds me the stuff that I've most heavily read before, right? It knows your preferences and that gives you more and more of that. Well, during the campaign, I was a heavy reader of The Nation, of The Atlantic, of Huffington Post, of The Daily Beast, of all sorts of other sources that were kind of coming at the Trump campaign from my perspective, which is, what the hell is going on? For the last 8 months, I've been seeing these things come up on my Google News feed and seeing a provocative headline about some latest Trump administration outrage, and then not reading the story. And then looking at, you know, another one from The Atlantic, which is one of the finest publications this country has to offer, and I haven't read that story either. And, you know, down the list, I'm like, why? Well, here's why. Because I knew what they were going to say. I'm not saying that they would have been unilluminating, but I thought that I was facing a foregone conclusion. And what I read might have, you know, given me some sort of
validation.
It may have fed my rage and sense of righteousness, but I wasn't going to learn anything new. But just 8 months ago, I'm advocating for us to kind of stay the course.
No, you are advocating for us to veer off the course onto the front of the movement, which we hadn't been before.
Well, during the campaign.
The campaign, we were not, you know, screaming, resist, resist, resist. There wasn't yet anything to resist.
Well,
perceive how we did that differently.
Well, because we both do a lot of stuff on this show, but your work is very much, I would say, characterized by taking the long view and tons of historical perspective. And mine is very much characterized by, oh my God, oh my God. So my panic and your level-headedness together created a certain vibe, which I think hasn't changed gigantically since the elections. But now, while my convictions have changed not one whit, while my fear and my anger and my shame are as strong as they were in that very fraught conversation, I think that I should dial it back. Because I don't want our audience at some point to lose interest in our reporting and our commentary, because it's just a foregone conclusion for them, too. How horrible would it be for my self-righteousness to die at its own hands? Your clear-eyed vision or my impulse to say the sky is falling? What should we do? Which way should we go?
It sounds like you've turned a corner.
I've turned a corner because I realized that the potential toll of being self-righteous.
It sounds like you don't want to read someone like you.
That's exactly it. Do I want to listen to me? Increasingly, no.
You know, probably my favorite tweet of yours in this period is when somebody tweeted, oh, Brooke and Bob, please don't die, we need you, or something. And you responded, do you remember?
a wrong addressee, please forward to Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. That was a good one.
Well, Bob Garfield, thank you very much.
Brooke Gladstone, thank you very much.
My name is Carl Glocken, and this is a ship of fools. I'm a fool, and you'll meet more fools as we go along. This tub is packed with them. Emancipated ladies, ball players, lovers, dog lovers, ladies of joy, tolerant Jews, dwarfs, all kinds. And who knows, if you look closely enough, you may even find yourself on board.
Coming up on this week's show, producer Michael Loewinger traveled to Sweden to see for himself a Wild West theme park that was housing refugees. It's a tale of cowboys and Syrians that you have to hear to believe. And as ever, run, don't walk, to sign up for our weekly newsletter at onthemedia.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Garfield.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.